I'd like to share a revelation I've had about your species. I've noticed that humans will consistently sacrifice the quality of a thing they like in order to acquire it conveniently. Take, for example, coffee. Even though every human knows if they start with freshly roasted beans, they will get a better cup of coffee. Humans will make their coffee from stale beans simply because they're available at the grocery store or their local cafe. But this insanity can finally come to an end because the Matrix has introduced spark plug coffee. That's right, spark plug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that spark plug delivers this exceptional coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it so that it reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. And I promise you will taste the difference. You can order spark plug as you need it, or you can take advantage of their autopilot set it and forget it delivery so that the system will always keep you flush with fresh coffee. And right now, Sparkplug has a special offer for Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, that's all one word, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? Take the blue pill and stay in a world where you can make the best coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
You're more than a hot drink to us. You're our coffee and our father.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey there, hi there, ho there, motion picture enthusiasts. And thank you as always for downloading the next 144 project. We reviewed all the AFI's Top 100 movies from both the 1998 and 2007 lists. You can find every single one of those shows in our chronicles, in fact. Now that that task is long done, we gander back at films that cause us to raise an eyebrow or two. Your eyebrows needn't furrow if you don't like spoilers, because we're warning you now that we will spoil this film and probably some other ones. I'm the office drone who believes there is no spoon, Ryan Ellis, and here's the badass who knows kung fu, my wife Bev.
That's me.
We should have taken the blue pill.
Oh, I'm all over the blue pill.
Ignorance is bliss. The directors, at this time, Andy and Larry Wachowski, now, of course, Lana and Lily Wachowski, say, or that at one point recorded as saying, they would take the blue pill. And this is their movie. Writers, directors, producers. Before we get fully into The Matrix, we should talk about the fact this is our 6th anniversary today.
Is it really?
March 25th, 2013, now March 25th, 2019.
Happy anniversary, babe.
Yeah, last year we threw out Citizen Kane on our anniversary, a re-release, a recut version of that. We have nothing special today other than this episode of The Matrix, but anyway, 6 years later. You and I will also hit episode number 300 in a few months, although because of the scoring of the movies episodes I did with Chris, or I've been doing with Chris, we've long since passed 300 in total on this channel. All right then, the coming attractions trivia for this week's movie, The Matrix, the last movie we have in March. This is one of three Keanu Reeves movies we're planning to review in 2019. Can you guess what the other two are? You, the listeners, anybody?
Well, you gave me a hint before that anniversaries have something to do with it. I forgot to look this up, but I think I've got it, because in 1989, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure came out, which turns 30 this year.
That'd be a fun one, but no, I never thought about that.
What? Really? Oh my god, maybe we should do it. Okay, Speed was from 1994, so that movie turns 25 this year.
That's correct, and we'll actually release it on the date it got released 25 years ago, June 10th.
I have to guess what the one you were thinking of.
You picked the right year, 1989.
Oh, is that Point Break then?
No, Parenthood.
Oh, Parenthood!
I'm a big fan of that movie. It's one of those I like. We don't even have kids, and I love that movie. I liked the first time I saw it. I like it a lot more now. I think the actors are great.
I think that's part of what the appeal is, too. It's a very human movie. It's a relatable movie.
And Keanu has a pretty important role as one of the younger actors in that movie, one of the younger characters. He's not one of the key members. Steve Martin is the headlining star, but he is in the film, and he's actually quite good. Okay, The Matrix didn't exist in time to make the 1998 AFI Top 100 list, but was nominated in 2007, and I'm a little bit surprised, just a little, that it didn't make that list.
Agreed.
Some other less influential films made it, like Last Picture Show, for example, very good movie, but does anyone really talk about that movie the way they still talk about this one 20 years later? This game-changing blockbuster was released by Warner Brothers just a few days shy of 20 years ago on March 31st, 1999. I remember seeing it in the theater. I thought it was fun, but I didn't love it as much as I certainly do now. I bought it on DVD almost on a whim when I got a stereo or something like that and said, oh, I'll take that movie too. Watched that night and thought, what was I talking about? This is a great movie, not just a good one. Maybe because I saw it in some cavernous theater where I felt like I was hundreds of feet away from the screen. Anyway, one of my favorites from a very good year, 1999. You should probably tell us what the movie's about, though, even though I think people know what The Matrix is, but I know you have a good skinny, so lay it on us.
Okay. So, there's this guy named Neo who's a hacker, and he meets Trinity, who's also a hacker, and she's like, you really need to meet Morpheus. So he does, but not before he's snatched by these gnarly agents who scare him. Morpheus offers Neo a pill, which makes him discover that they're actually living in the future, and machines have taken over the Earth, and they're using humans for batteries, but subduing them with a dream world called The Matrix. And the scary agents stop people from exposing the truth, but we can use this technology to teach you Kung Fu, and also, you're the hero we've been waiting for. The Oracle said so. Then the agents get Morpheus, and Neo uses his new powers to save him. Him and Trinity totally make out. Then he flies. The end.
Guess that's it for the podcast.
Summing it up. The movie is very plot-heavy, and it is almost strangely entirely exposition. It's really an origin story because it just seems to be telling you about the world. And of course, there's the fantastic action sequences, but there's really not much else to the story other than explaining what the world is and how it works.
That's true. And you read that faster than even I can talk, so way to go. Or in a nutshell, Neo is an anagram for one.
Whoa.
Before we get into the body of the podcast, let's get through some Rotten Tomatoes and box office numbers, and we'll talk about all three movies. I know you're not a fan of the sequels, but I have some surprising numbers for you. I think they'll be surprising. The first movie, 88% of critics liked it, 128 fresh reviews, 18 rotten, and 85% of audiences, so damn good scores. It's also 18th on the IMDb's top 250. Matrix Reloaded, the first sequel, Rotten Tomatoes numbers, 73 and 72. So they're fresh reviews. And Revolutions, and Revolutions, 36. But 60, so the audiences give it a very marginal fresh tomato.
So this is my theory, because when I saw Matrix Reloaded, I was definitely disappointed, but I remember thinking, let's hold our judgment, because Revolutions is going to bring it all home, and then we're all going to suddenly get it, and it'll totally be worth it, and they totally know what they're doing. So I had a lot of optimism coming out of Reloaded, and then Revolutions just crushed it.
A lot of people felt that way, I think. These two sequels had huge opening weekends as well. Gigantic ones. The first one was fifth at the 1999 U.S. box office. The Phantom Menace, the Star Wars movie, was unsurprisingly number one. And The Sixth Sense, which we covered for the Top Runner project long ago, was number two. Reloaded is easily Reeves' biggest hit in real dollars or adjusted for inflation. And that also goes for the Wachowskis. But that does go back to the curiosity of this movie. I remember The Dark Knight when it came out. Batman Begins was successful, but not a huge hit, really. And then Dark Knight, everyone had to see it based on, I don't know, I guess the trailers and the word of mouth. And then, of course, it was one of the biggest hits of
also,
all time.
Also, Heath Ledger died. I think that added to a lot of the legend of it.
And everyone thought this would be that much more impressive. The trailers were cool. The animatrix had come out in the meantime.
Oh, my God. The anticipation, at least for me, the second movie came out, I was 25 years old. I was pretty close to their key demographic. And I was in that world. I was so optimistic.
So for Keanu, I talked about his box office hits. His five biggest hits, adjusted for inflation, of course, now. First, it's Reloaded, like I said. Then it's this movie, The Matrix. Then it's Speed, which we said we're going to cover. Parenthood, which we said we're going to cover. And Revolutions.
Wow, John Wick is not on this list.
The first one's not that big a hit. The second one was a bigger hit, but not even close to the top five for Keanu. The Wachowskis, though, not so much. Their three Matrix films are huge hits, and then nothing else they've made has really been all that successful. But you have to admire one thing about them, including the Matrix sequels, as much as you may not like them. They do shoot for the moon, if not the stars, if not for the end of the universe, yeah, unlike a lot of other directors.
They shoot for the moon with, instead of a rocket, it's like they put a bunch of fireworks on the end of a Cadillac and expected it to get to the moon.
They probably needed a stronger producer for the sequels. Joel Silver produced this one. I didn't look up if he produced the sequels or not, but he was a pretty powerful guy and a pretty headstrong producer, and maybe that's one reason why this movie stands out and the other ones don't so much.
And this was all happening around the same time as the Star Wars prequels were consistently disappointing people. This is when I first came up with my George Lucas syndrome theory. Once you convince somebody that they alone are responsible for the success of something and then give them total artistic control, sometimes it works out and sometimes it becomes the Phantom Menace, and sometimes it becomes Matrix Revolutions.
Christopher Nolan seems to be in that category now, although he keeps on making movies that people like, box office-wise, generally, and also critically. One of these days, he's going to go too far with something, probably, and it's going to fail. But you have to admire people that are trying big-time things. Now, one thing about this movie, let's get this out of the way right now, is that the Wachowskis are now transgendered, and this happened quite a few years ago. They were 4 years apart, though. It was Larry that became Lana, and then Andy, many years later, became Lily. So you look online, it says she, her, and all that, into all the descriptions. Well, no, when they made these movies, they were men. So if I call them men, I don't mean to be offending the transgender community, but when we talk about these three movies they made, they were men at the time, but of course they're women now.
I would argue that they've always been women. They just are now okay. presenting
I just want to make the point that if I call them men, I'm not trying to offend anybody. We knew them as Larry and Andy back at this time. So for all the things The Matrix is, the main storyline is the hero's journey. We've talked about this in a lot of movies before. Luke Skywalker, Harry Potter, and like those two, bit of a blank slate here with Keanu Reeves. He's probably the perfect casting. They talked about Will Smith, Johnny Depp, Brad Pitt, Ewan McGregor. You look online, all those names are in the conversation. Will Smith especially is the one you hear the most about. But maybe Reeves was the best casting because he is this blank slate type actor. He's got the physicality. He's certainly a good looking guy. He's got charisma. He's a likable guy too. Seems like a good dude. But he's been criticized a lot for his performances over the years as well. This is probably his quintessential performance, the one that he'll be remembered for when he dies. What do you think about him? What do you think about the hero's journey thing?
Oh, I totally agree about the hero's journey. I mean, it's somebody who thinks he's just an average Joe, suddenly discovers he's the one who's going to rescue the world, much like Luke Skywalker, Harry Potter. And Keanu Reeves, he's so good at being a cipher for the audience. I've never thought he was the greatest actor, but he has this natural openness and curiosity that makes him really perfect for a role like this. As perfect as he was for Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, because he seems to have no ego on screen, or at the very least, his ego never seems to get in the movie's way. In the 90s, most action stars were these big, brawny, macho. It was Schwarzenegger, it was Stallone, it was Bruce Willis. They were huge stars, and all these movies were about machismo. For him to come out in what is clearly an action film, not like Harry Potter, where you have a child in the role of the one, he's doing kung fu, he's actually doing the moves and shooting guns and pulling it off. Like you said, he has a physicality, he has this real physical grace. He pulls off the fighting scenes like a dancer.
They train for months.
Oh, you can tell because it is so smooth, every meticulous motion. One of the best things about this movie, I think part of the reason it will endure past all of the parodies, past the point where all of its ideas feel dated, and certainly the clothes of technology can feel very dated, the action scenes are so outstanding. The fight scenes have so much athleticism and just plain coolness.
And they're exciting.
And they're exciting. A lot of the credit does go to the actors, who, of course, worked really hard with trainers. Maybe Will Smith could have pulled it off, but I don't care. Keanu Reeves is the one that did. And Keanu Reeves will always be Neo. Will Smith is the guy with the cool one-liners. Keanu Reeves
can Will Smith be this quiet? I don't know if he could have been back in 1999 or now. He apparently didn't take the Django role, the Tarantino film, because he had to kill the bad guy, he said. I think part of it was because Django in that movie doesn't speak that much. I think Will Smith thought, well, I got to have more screen time and be more the star. I like Will Smith, but he seems like his ego's a little out of control. And you mentioned Keanu doesn't seem to have that problem. I think I read somewhere in the first half of the movie, he barely speaks at all. His most dialogue is more towards the end. His closing voiceover when he's on the phone, that's probably the most dialogue he has in any one stretch in the entire movie.
Which is funny, because you don't realize it. Morpheus does so much talking.
Even like, Trinity.
Yeah.
Agent Smith.
They're kind of the ones explaining everything. Oh yeah, Agent Smith actually does a ton of talking. So they do need these characters to tell the audience what's going on, because the plot is complex. Some could argue needlessly complex. But they kind of had to do some workarounds to make it all make sense.
He is Morpheus the Explainer, for Neo's sake, but certainly more for ours than for Neo. You have to have that character in a movie that doesn't know something that has to have it explained for them. The newbie in whatever the thing is, so they can explain it to them, and therefore they're explaining it to us. Especially in a movie sci-fi like this, where weird things are happening.
And it helps when you have a hero's journey type film to have somebody who is a blank slate like Neo, because there's a huge element of fantasy fulfillment. We all wish we could wake up one day and discover we're a superhero.
We were always special underneath. Waiting
for. We were always special. Somebody knew it and they finally found us. And now not only are they going to hold us in high regard, but they're going to help us literally save the world. You're human if you enjoy that fantasy.
Except we've already admitted that We'd rather be in the blissful matrix ignorance. Oh my god,
I'm gonna be like Joey Pantaleone.
Pantaleano. Joey
you.
Pants.
Joey Pants. I'll always be Joey Pants eating a steak.
We covered him in Memento recently, and then Chris and I did Ready to Rumble not that long ago. He's done all those villainous roles and a ton of movie roles in general. So he's Cypher in the real world of this movie, but Agent Smith during that steak dinner calls him Reagan. He wants to be important, like an actor.
Haha, like Joey Pants.
And I don't want to remember anything, and people have pointed out that that's Ronald Reagan's arc. He's an important man, he's an actor, and he had Alzheimer's, everyone seems to think was true.
Oh, yeah! What a great observation.
We've been talking about the hero's journey. Another hero character that came a few years after this, the same year as the first Harry Potter movie, was Frodo in Lord of the Rings. And while they were shooting this movie in Sydney, LOTR was shooting in New Zealand around that same time. Partly they were shot there for the cost situation. Now, New Zealand was also because Peter Jackson's from there. The Wachowskis, I don't think, have any connection to Australia, but it was a lot cheaper to shoot the movie there.
Yeah, they just got tax refunds.
Seems to be they've set it in Chicago, which is where the Wachowskis are from. It never says it's Chicago, but a lot of street names are that, and I think the area code that's shown at one point in the movie is a Chicago area code. When the movie begins, though, we hear, I think it's the very first line of the film, Cypher's on the phone with Trinity, and one of them says, "Are you sure this line is clean?" So I think we get right from the very beginning that Cypher is already in cahoots with the agents, because it seems to be it's a setup to maybe get her killed. She barely escapes.
Plus, the line's not clean, in a sense, because we as voyeurs are listening in on their phone call.
Right, we're the agents,
it
too.
It feels like you are sneakily listening in on their phone call, so you automatically can suspect that something is afoot.
And then later on, when Neo comes up behind Cypher and sees him working on monitors, and he quickly turns them off because he's setting up so he can go to the Matrix to have that meeting with the agents. And I don't think it's the first time he's ever met with the agents, as he makes his deal to sell them out. But he dies in the real world, so he never gets to live his life as Reagan, eating steak, or thinking he's eating steak. One of the influences from this movie is a lot of people think the Matrix is real. A lot of real people think the Matrix is real, and we've been in it the whole time.
Elon Musk thinks the Matrix is real. He said there's a 1 in billions chance that we're not living in a simulation, and there are rumors that he has hired scientists to break us out. Speaking of egos.
Oh, he has a gigantic one.
Oh, yeah.
So in that action-packed opening when Trinity runs away from the agents, it's interesting it doesn't even involve the main hero. Neo hasn't been introduced yet. They're talking about him, but we don't see him on screen until after that sequence. And the star of that whole thing is a newcomer. She'd been in movies before, but Carrie Ann Moss's first big role was this. We covered her in Memento not that long ago. We thought she was okay in that movie. I actually was more impressed with her than ever in seeing this viewing. I've seen this movie so many times. Maybe because we're noticing more that women never got the credit in roles. So they'd get a role like this, which is cool. And she's given third billing. She might have been second billed if she was a bigger star compared to Lawrence Fishburne. Because she's definitely the second most important actor in the movie behind him. But in a way, she's the most important. I just saw the Lego Movie Part 2 not long ago. And they actually acknowledge in the movie that Wildstyle, the Elizabeth Banks character, does way more in the first film than Emmett does. She is the badass. She's the hero. He does things in the movie, but it's her movie, it's her story, it's her action. Obviously, Neo does stuff in this movie, too, and does become a true hero, but it's more because of her than anything else. Her faith in him, her love for him, and the fact that they're a great team. Right before the most famous moment in this movie, and the thing I've said before, we'll use this up to make sure the speakers for our surround sound system are working, is the bullet dodge, because you hear the bullets go at every single speaker in sequence, and that's always been my test to make sure that I've set it up properly. But right before that moment happens, when the agent's shooting at him, he's dodging the bullets and doesn't even know he can do it until he does it, what does he say to her? He shoots all his guns. The agent does the same thing, dodging bullets. He says, "Trinity, help!" They're a team. He needs her. But at that moment, he really needs her. So she's never given enough credit for how cool and awesome and important she is in this movie.
And Morpheus is the damsel in distress. She is never. So often, you'll have a character like Trinity, but then they just wind up being motivation for the hero to save her. But meanwhile, she's just helping him save the true damsel in distress, which is Morpheus. It's crazy that Carrie Ann Moss never became an action star after this. Her athleticism, and I think there was one point in the film, I can't remember what scene it was, but she's doing something amazing. And you kind of muttered under your breath, she's such a badass. Mm-hmm. Her strut and her confidence and just how good she is at everything, it's so convincing. And she's the one who, right from the get-go, is good at everything. She doesn't have a training montage because she doesn't need one. She already knows kung fu. She's already presumably been in all kinds of situations just like this before. And she seems hyper-competent and knowledgeable. She follows Morpheus, but you kind of feel like if Morpheus goes down, I mean, he ultimately does in one of the sequels.
No, then... he doesn't.
Oh, that's right, he doesn't.
She does, but he doesn't.
That's right, because you would think if Morpheus ever went down, she could take his place immediately.
Well, like Ripley on Alien, she's the ranking officer on the ship. She's not second in command. And Alien, she's third in command. But Kane dies, so she's second in command because he's dead. Same kind of role in some ways, isn't it? And one of the coolest moments in the whole film is a simple one, but it's after she gets the helicopter information uploaded into her brain.
Yes.
And says, let's go. You mentioned strut. She struts the helicopter. That's badass and cool right there.
One of my favorite stunts in the whole film is when she's hanging from the rope from the helicopter and she lands on the building and there's that ripple effect. Oh, God. No matter how many times I've seen it, it still gives me chills.
Also, great part of the music score in that sequence.
Yeah.
If you can picture that or hear that in your head right now. I read she hurt her ankle during this movie. She played hurt through a lot of it.
She broke her ankle in one of the takes. Okay. It was in the lobby scene when one of the landings she made, she broke her ankle. Apparently she worked for the rest of the day and nobody even knew until the day was over that she hurt herself. And the take where she breaks her ankle, I think is the take that they used.
When she does one of those flips that no human being could ever do. Yeah.
I think most of the film, especially the action, has aged pretty well, but I actually find the lobby scene a little dumb now. Those security guards are worse than stormtroopers. There are so many bullets, and there's no reason why they wouldn't be getting hit by an absolute spray of bullets.
They just because you're
doing a cartwheel. That's not going to stop you from getting hit by a bullet. It's cool to look at.
And multiple people.
Yeah, exactly. Just because you're doing backflips doesn't mean you're impervious to bullets.
And trained military people. Well, just like in Star Wars, if you look from a different point of view, they're terrorists. Same with this. These guys go into a military building.
Killing innocent people, really.
And both at that point, maybe Neo too, but certainly Morpheus and Trinity are considered terrorists in this world. They belong in jail for many reasons, and they do kill. Now, they don't really kill because it is the Matrix, but they officially kill a lot of people in that sequence. There's some good stuff in that too, because when the bomb comes down later on, there is no spoon. And it blows up the lobby. You don't see any of the bodies, and you don't see any of the damage from all the shooting from before. The pillars are back to being normal again. I never noticed that until I read that online, if I'd seen the movie two or three times.
I never noticed it until you mentioned it.
But it also does provide a cool sound effect, because when the door goes flying past the camera, you can hear it go almost like it's over you, and you hear the surround sound. That's a great surround sound movie. Another good example of that, where you hear the door fly behind you and the speakers behind.
Technically, there are few better action movies in history. Pulling off action scenes, the audio, the special effects.
The last 30 minutes, basically, is pure action. It's almost a James Cameron movie in that way, although he's gone even longer than 30 minutes straight. Things like Aliens and even The Terminator, with very few lulls for huge sequences. Let's get back to the beginning where we meet Neo. He's asleep when we first see him. He wakes up a lot in this movie, in fact, especially when he's brought into the real world and has to recover.
Thematically appropriate.
Mm-hmm. I always have to ask this question when you see a character asleep the first time we meet him. I don't think it's true, but I'll ask the question. Is everything we watch a dream?
Most of the film is, in a sense, a dream. It is all going on strictly in their heads. It has real-life consequences, like Inception, which is a movie that was influenced by The Matrix. My theory, and this is based more on stuff that happens in the sequels, Zion is part of The Matrix.
The end of Revolution suggests, doesn't say it straight out, when the Oracle and the Architect are talking at the end of that movie, that the whole thing we watched was a simulation. Yeah. That these two characters we're watching are their avatars, maybe they look nothing like this, and they're jacked in. It's maybe this level upon a level upon a level. But at the very least, whatever world they're in, maybe that's the real world we see at the very end of that movie. That could be argued too. I think it's the one time the sun ever rises in any of these films is the end of the third movie. But they don't say it straight out. It sounds like what we just witnessed was all a big game. The supposed real world and the Matrix stuff. Because at the end of Reloaded, Neo can do things that you couldn't do in the real world. Exactly. He can use his Matrix powers for some reason in the real world.
You have Neo being able to control stuff in Zion. You have Agent Smith being able to travel between the Matrix and Zion. These things don't make any sense whatsoever unless Zion is part of the Matrix. I remember going into Revolutions being sure that they were going to discover that Zion was just another level of the Matrix, and then the world wasn't even as bad as they said. It was in the interest of the machines to convince humans that the world was a desolate, terrible place that had been totally destroyed by the war, when in fact it was fine, but they wanted to trick them into believing that so that they wouldn't then carry on to fight for Zion rather than prefer to remain in the Matrix.
Or it's just a video game between the Oracle and the Architect.
Oh my God, yeah, it could be. Well,
Bob and Betty, two regular people that are just playing a video game.
They could all be AIs, in a sense. They could all be computer programs built to amuse the Architect and the Oracle. And the Architect says this is the sixth time the Matrix has happened.
Right.
This happens over and over. And every single time there's a one. And every single time this happens, it is one of the muddiest speeches in cinematic history. Mm-hmm. The Architect trying to explain the Matrix to Neo. But he does say this has happened over and over again. So yeah, it would make sense. Like a video game. Not just Elon Musk, but actual scientists seriously consider the idea that we are all living in a simulation and we are all part of some big game. It is strangely attractive to a lot of people, the idea that our world is not what we think it is. The idea that there is something we could wake up to, and then even if it's horrible, it has this exciting idea of being a truth that we know that other people don't know.
It's something else.
What is the appeal? The obvious appeal that it gives Neo an advantage that kind of makes him a superhuman, which also makes him a target, and also gives him all these horrible responsibilities of saving humanity. What do you think of that idea? Do you want to stare at a spoon and be able to bend it and understand that reality is not what you believe it to be?
I don't know. I said before I would take the blue pill.
Oh, I would take the blue
pill. Our lives are pretty ordinary, and a lot of people would probably say they're dull, but we're pretty happy with the ordinariness of it. I can't imagine, this kind of goes for God, too, the notion that a supposed God has watched over, what would it be now, tens of billions of people in the history of the world, maybe more than that. And has been interested in every single one of them doing the most mundane things. We see a bum at one point in this movie get taken over by one of the agents, and that's when the big fight towards the end in the subway station happens with Neo and Agent Smith. But that had been a bum. So he's jacked in too, just living his life of begging for change and barely getting by. It seems odd that that would be the fact.
Unnecessarily cruel. But maybe that's part of how the film works inside of like a common mythology of Judeo-Christianity, that we all were brought up with the belief of an omnipotent being, a god, or be a god or an AI of the future. People always resist the notion of chaos and would prefer everything happens for a reason. Even if that reason is something nefarious, like the pacification of the human race, there is this appeal. People obviously like the idea of an omnipotent force of some kind controlling our lives. And then on top of that, it would seem even extra appealing to think, yeah, but I'm the special one that can overcome the limitations.
I'm not responsible, but I'm also a god waiting to happen. I can fly at the end. It's also a Jesus metaphor. Agent Smith says to Morpheus, forgetting Jesus for a second, but just religion. He says to Morpheus when he's interrogating him, we had this perfect utopia and you rejected it, suggesting the Garden of Eden.
Oh yeah, of course.
But then Neo is Jesus because he comes back to life. He's the savior, obviously. That dialogue's even said by the guy who picks up the computer disks. He rises into the sky at the very end. He's able to fly, but rising into the sky specifically. His name, Anderson, his real world name, Thomas Anderson, means son of man. And when I said that to somebody I work with, she was mad at me for even suggesting, but I just read online about how there's this metaphor, and I'd seen the movie not long before. And I was just saying, I read this, and she got, not my idea. But now that I've seen the movie many times, I think about Superman, I think about E.T., I think about the day the Earth stood still. I think all of those, whether they're intended that way or not, Spielberg has said E.T. is not supposed to be a Jesus metaphor, but my God, it sure seems to be.
Is his name Carpenter in the day the Earth stood still?
Yeah.
He's definitely intended to be a Jesus
metaphor. Also dies and goes back to life. So he said Neo wakes up when we first meet him, and he's been hacking and whatnot. Seems like that's what he does in his free time all the time. He works at Metacortex, and his boss looks something like Agent Smith, I noticed this time.
Probably Metacortex, a deliberate choice. What an appropriate name.
His hiding place for the discs when he does whatever is hacking for people and gets paid for it is Simulacra, I think is how you pronounce that, and Simulation. And these were books that all the cast had to read. I remember Keanu especially was given a lot of books he had to read to try to understand what they were going for in this movie. The Wachowskis, when they tried to get this movie made, they wrote the script a long time before 1999, but they couldn't get anyone to actually buy the script until they had some storyboards and people could finally visualize what they wanted to go for.
And they still had to go make Bound to prove that they could make a feature film to get The Matrix made. And if anybody here hasn't seen the movie Bound, I'd say it's their second best film after The Matrix. It's not perfect. It has some pretty corny stuff, but damn, it is fun and not campy, but I don't know, meaty.
Delicious.
Delicious. Yes, that's a great word for it.
And Jennifer Tilly's best performance, and certainly her best 3 seconds on a screen where she's on a phone saying something like, I need help, hangs with the phone and goes from playing like she's panicked to completely placid because, if not the whole time, at that moment, she's just putting on a front.
Yeah.
She's terrific in that movie. Joey Pants is in that film as well.
Yes, he is. If you saw Bound, then you would not be surprised by just how cool The Matrix looks, because Bound is a cool-looking movie.
Well, a friend of ours, Carl, loves Speed Racer, which was one of their movies after Revolutions. It may have been the next movie after Revolutions.
I discovered through him that Speed Racer has a cult following. They had a screening at this massive IMAX theater in Toronto. It wasn't sold out, but it did pretty well, and he said it was pretty fun to be there with all the other Speed Racer fans.
It's a good-looking movie, at least. We've talked about their names, and of course in the real world they have different names. We don't know what Trinity's name was in the real world, but we know Neo's real name. But we just talked a few minutes ago about religion. Well, also, I think there's a slave metaphor going on there, because a lot of people who were slaves changed, not so much slaves, I guess, but black people. Muhammad Ali was Cassius Clay, and then he became Muhammad Ali. Malcolm X was Malcolm Little, became Malcolm X. Well, they have their own names because they want to rename themselves, but I think it's a bit of a play on that.
And both the directors have renamed themselves. There is a thing in trans culture, it's called dead naming, when someone transitions and they give themselves a new name, and very often it'll be something completely different from the name that they were brought up with, because they consider that to be the mask that they wore, and it is something they want to completely divorce themselves from. So it's considered an insult to call them by their old name, and it's called dead naming. And there's a scene in The Matrix where the agent calls him Mr. Anderson, and he's like, "My name is Neo!" And maybe that's how they felt when they finally transitioned and they got to call themselves by their true names and express their true identities.
Well, Larry and Lana are pretty close together, but Andy and Lily are not at all. So Andy really did go far away from his original name. It is interesting. I don't know much about transgender people, but it is curious or interesting to me that brothers would do this. It's one thing for one of them to do it.
What a coincidence.
And it was a couple years before that Lana became Lana. So you'd see her and you'd see Andy still being Andy. I think it was around the time they were doing maybe Jupiter Ascending, or anyway, sometime around that point. But then he became a woman as well. So now they both are.
They're Wachowski sisters? Do they go by that now? The Wachowski sisters?
I think it's siblings. Maybe they became siblings probably when Andy was still Andy. That may have been what it was.
Yeah. And maybe they just call themselves the Wachowskis now. I think I've seen that, or I've heard people call them that, just to avoid misnaming them.
Well, we didn't mean to do this, but we've done three straight female directors then, if we're going by the logic that they're women now, even though they weren't during the film, because we had Penelope Spheeris doing Wayne's World last week, and next week we've got Amy Heckerling.
Hey, what do you know? You know what's a cool thing to think about and talk about, and maybe use as an argument for inclusion in Hollywood, is if Lana and Lily had been born women, we wouldn't have The Matrix. Or if Lana and Lily had transitioned before 1999, we wouldn't have The Matrix. And I think we're all pretty glad that The Matrix exists, and it's a movie and culture that we all get to enjoy. It was incredibly influential and has just given the world so much pleasure. It was made by two women, two trans women people. We need to give opportunities to all different kinds, because this is the talent we would be missing out on.
They haven't made a movie since, I guess it's Jupiter Ascending, and that was 2015, I think?
They have Sense 8 on Netflix as well.
Oh, I didn't look at TV stuff. My IMDb profile separates movies and TV shows, and I didn't think to look for a TV. Okay, there you go. But their movie profile, nothing's even in the hopper.
One of the reviews that I read had this great observation. It was like a retrospective review of The Matrix. They considered the Wachowskis to be oddball directors that just happened to get their big commercial success movie really early out of the gate before they made their true nerd culture stuff, and they probably would have had very different underground careers, which is maybe what they should have had, rather than starting off as super popular and then disappointing people by making these niche films.
Let's get back into the Matrix storyline here. So one of the big scenes in the whole movie, of course, is when Neo and Morpheus fight for the first time. The characters on the Nebuchadnezzar ship are pretty excited about it, because when they find out from Mouse that the two they're fighting, they all run away from the little lunchroom to go watch it happening. We talked about all the training they did, and it really shows there. Lawrence Fishburne and Keanu Reeves go at it for quite a while with Kung Fu and all kinds of other martial arts. So that leads us into a guy we talked about not that long ago in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Yuen Woo-ping, who also choreographed this movie, I guess the sequels, I didn't look that up, and also Kill Bill, and a ton of Asian movies, I guess Chinese movies. And of course they had to digitally erase the wires in this movie, just like those other ones. When you look at all the stunts, maybe Kill Bill is the most impressive and the coolest in some ways. Crouching Tiger did it before. No, this was before Crouching Tiger. Which do you think is the most impressive wire work?
The Matrix looks the realest, whereas Crouching Tiger, I said this when we did the podcast, that it's a little too much. They're a little too anti-gravity, and Kill Bill uses it so sparingly, so it's just meant to make the fighters look a little more athletic than they are.
That's true.
And probably just help them pull off moves they couldn't otherwise pull off. I think that the Goldilocks perfect one is The Matrix. I love Kill Bill, but if you're going to ask about specifically wire work and the choreography of the fights, I have to go with Matrix.
It's also a fantasy world within the storyline, so you can believe that they can do maybe not anything, although Neo at the end can do anything because he finally believes he is the one.
There's a sound explanation for why he can move like that.
Neo proves he's the one right after saying he's not the one to Trinity. Although it's more a matter of having guts, because when she's going down that helicopter, and he hangs on rather than actually getting rid of the cable around his waist. If he's not right, if she doesn't get out of there as fast as she does and swing down, and you talked about that scene already, he's going to get pulled down in that helicopter. Now, maybe he could suddenly learn to fly then. He'd have to. He's got to pull the weight of a helicopter and a woman to do that. But it is interesting that he had just said, I'm not the one, and then he proves in the next few minutes of the movie that he is. He also ends up in the same hotel room where Trinity was in the beginning of the movie. When she's caught by the police and does the first bullet time move, when she does that whoop, and she hangs in the air doing the crane and kicks the cop across the room, that's where he goes to get to that ringing phone to finally get back into the real world. And I also love the detail. The phone is always ringing, and of course it would be. The whole time, if you listen for it, the music doesn't ever really fully drown it out either when he realizes that he is the one. He doesn't have to dodge bullets anymore. He can simply stop them, pull them out of the air and drop them, and then run into Agent Smith. And just like Agent Smith accused human beings of being, he's a virus because he gets inside of him and blows him up.
Okay, so this is where I get to introduce my second wacky theory about the Matrix. This is a little more far-fetched, I think, than the idea that Zion is part of the Matrix. Neo is not the one. We know that the Oracle lies to people and tells them exactly what they need to know. So she either lied to Trinity or she lied to Neo. Perhaps she was lying to both of them, and the true one is Agent Smith. Somebody who was born in the Matrix, who dies and comes back to life, and then destroys the Matrix. And in Revolutions, Agent Smith changes the Matrix dramatically, which I think is another thing about the One, that they can change the Matrix. And he changes the nameless city that they're in quite a bit, changes all these people into just copies of himself. When he is destroyed, the Matrix is destroyed along with him. So perhaps he's the one, unwittingly in a way, although wittingly because he hates his life, he hates humanity, he hates his job.
Stink. He's the Neville Longbottom.
Only less likable. He's a great villain, though. I say he's less likable. And actually, he makes sense when he says, oh, humanity is a virus. Mm. Yeah, kind of.
We are.
Yeah.
He's not wrong. Like,
we kind of are destroying our own world.
Well, Smith is an agent of chaos, especially the sequels. But even in this one, in the sequels, he's gone rogue. He's not even part of the Matrix anymore. He admits that when he first meets Neo. Hello, Mr. Anderson. And Hugo Weaving, I mentioned Lord of the Rings, of course, was in those movies, and then V for Vendetta. He's had a hell of a career. I don't know. He had done things before this, because he was in that Adventures of Priscilla movie in 1994.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And probably some other New Zealand or Australian productions around the same point. More so Australian productions, I guess. We talked about who's the one. Well, there's also a line that Morpheus has where he says, there's a difference between knowing the path and walking the path. And that reminds me of Yoda's line of, try not, do or do not. There is no try. Although that's also a load of crap, because trying does mean something in the real world. The real world. You do have to try, and you're not always going to succeed at things, so Yoda's kind of wrong there, too.
You heard it here first, guys. Yoda's full of shit.
But I do get what Morpheus is saying. There's a difference between what you're told or what someone says you can read in a book and actually being the leader that sets the tone and walks the path. We talked before about Neo using guns in this movie. He shoots at the agent before the bullet time scene. Well, the second one. I guess the first one is when Trinity does it. Is it only those two? Well, definitely the more famous one is when Neo dodges the bullets. But he doesn't even use guns in the sequels. The One is beyond such things.
He fights one-handed, even, just to be cocky about it.
Yeah, well, even at the end of this movie, let alone the sequels. I already mocked this earlier. Marcus Chong, who plays Tank, not in the sequels, by the way. I don't know if he's a good actor or not. It's hard to say, but he's given some terrible dialogue, including what I mocked earlier. You're more than a leader to us. You're a father. We'll miss you always.
The Wachowskis, great story, terrible dialogue. I would have the same complaint about Bound. That movie has some embarrassing dialogue that the actors have to say. Another similarity to George Lucas, too. God-awful.
And James Cameron.
Oh, God, yes.
All people who write and direct and often produce their own movies, they're true auteurs. Visionaries, without a doubt. Technically, their movies are wonderful. But the dialogue could use some help. I said before, the last 30 minutes or so, the movie is almost just straight action. You get the lobby shootout when they go in there with all the guns, the bullet time on the roof scene. They save Morpheus. Now, our subwoofer's not the greatest one in the world. I've heard this on other people's subwoofers, which are way more impressive than ours. But when they come down in that helicopter, first of all, you hear the sound. But then when he uses that machine gun to assassinate the agents, somehow not hitting Morpheus.
Yeah.
The sound of that in other people's houses, ours was not bad. But in theirs, oh my God, you can feel it in your guts. This is a great bass movie. So they save Morpheus. You get the walking the path thing. the foot chase, the subway fight, and the very end when he is truly the one. A lot of things are packed into that last 30 minutes or so.
Like I said, the whole movie is in a way a first act. It's all exposition and setup. Part of the reason why the sequels are so disappointing, because at the end of the film is that exciting shot of him shooting up into the air and that great Rage Against the Machine song starts and, oh, what's going to happen? Where is this going? I can't wait to see what they do with this, because you really just watch an origin story. There's so little real plot. Morpheus gets kidnapped, he saves him. He learns about the world for about an hour, learns what he can do in it. There's Pepper in the occasional action scene. That's the whole thing.
I said before about Neo being Jesus. Morpheus is like a true follower, right down to the point where he sacrificed himself. Neo's what matters here.
He's like John the Baptist.
I guess so, yeah. He can't really be as certain as he is that this is the one to save everybody. Neo, even at that point, thinks he's not the one. So Morpheus has sacrificed himself for a cause that may not even be true, and he has knowledge of where Zion is, and he has access to all the other ships, apparently, somehow. No one else in his ship do, so he is more important than them at that point, until Neo is truly the one. I do have some reasonably good questions. This has been talked about online, so not really my reasonably good questions.
I have some questions, too.
But would humans really be a practical way to get all the power they need?
No. First of all,
it's a cool scene.
Wind power.
Great visual. Yeah. But
you have wind power, you have geothermic power. But even if you determined that humans make a great battery source, we're mammals. You're telling me there's no other mammal that you could enslave?
Big elephants.
Elephants, cows, docile
giraffes.
Sheep, anything. There's no way we are the best possible mammals that you could use as batteries.
And it's supposed to be several weeks because his hair grows in. But the idea that Neo can use his eyes at all as quickly as he can, because he's a newborn baby, effectively. Now, they know how to do these things. I guess it's the idea is that they've been doing this before, not to somebody as old as he is. Kind of like Luke Skywalker. He's going into this new world older than you're supposed to.
They do the whole acupuncture thing. They have science to help fix him. Also, when he wakes up, he truly is born. He comes out of like an amniotic sack.
And he's got no hair. He's bald. I heard that Keanu Reeves lost weight and shaved, I think, all of his body hair for that scene. Another reasonably good question. Why are cops just standing around outside the interrogation room when Morpheus is being interrogated? The agents get hit by the machine gun fire in that helicopter, and then you see them standing outside the room. The agents go into a couple of them, and they keep on shooting at Neo. Why are they just standing there in the first place and they hear a giant helicopter, and they should have been hearing through their radios about the assault in the basement or the main level minutes before?
Why are there only three agents? You're the Matrix. You have total control over everything about the world. But I don't know, four agents seems like too much.
Budget cutbacks. Yeah. Cost too much to have these guys.
I have a reasonably good question for you. I'm making the Matrix. Why 1999? Why not 1799 before there are telephones, before there is the computer and the internet, and when everybody, if they saw weird things happening, would probably just assume it's God? Make it 1099. Make it 99, period. And you could argue, oh, well, you need to accommodate for the fact that there's billions and billions of people. Yeah, but you control this universe. You can make 100 different matrixes and put all the people in their individual matrixes, and they're all just tilling the field and not really thinking about whether or not they're in a simulation. It wouldn't even occur to them.
It is funny how dank and dour the Matrix world is, and it's sort of sci-fi. It's not quite as futuristic as Blade Runner was at the time, or Star Wars is trying to be. But otherwise, it's basically our world.
They say that they chose 1999 because it was the peak of human civilization. Not that The Matrix is really a prescient film, necessarily. But in that respect, history may show that to be a prescient detail. Because if you think about it, 1999, 2 years before 9/11, think about the wonderful, foolish world we all lived in 1999, where we just did not have world problems. We didn't.
North Americans didn't.
North Americans didn't. But truly, in the last 20 years, the world in general has way bigger worries than it did in 1999. And especially considering it's an American movie about Americans. Was there ever a more peaceful, prosperous time than 1999?
You're forgetting also something important that was going to come at the end of this year, Y2K. which didn't end up being a problem, but everyone thought it might. A lot of people were worried we were going to lose all our computers and revert back to 1900 and there'd be huge chaos, especially with banking.
So the idea of our dependence on technology was very high on people's minds. The idea of the end of the world was something that people were really preoccupied with. This wasn't the only end of the world-ish movie. There were other films, they just weren't even nearly as good. A lot of studios released Armageddon-ish type movie, not the movie Armageddon, but what's the one I'm thinking of? Little Schwarzenegger's
Gabriel. What about the end of days?
End of days, yeah, with Gabriel Byrne. What a bad movie. You can tell they just rushed that out.
It's the only time Arnold ever died as a human in any of his movies. He died a lot of times in his movies, but never as a actual person, as a human being.
Oh, no kidding. Okay, I have one more reasonably good question. Neo is supposed to free humanity. What are they gonna do with 6 billion people all waking up hairless in their pods with their atrophied muscles and their not working eyes? And they're going to be hungry. What are you going to do with all those people? Is that, honest to God, your goal? Because it seems like a logistical nightmare.
Yeah, Zion couldn't fit all those people. What we see in the sequel, Zion's a pretty big place, but not big enough for billions of people. Probably not even millions of people.
Way underground where they can be warmed by the Earth because the Earth's surface is cold because there's no sun anymore. So you have a very limited amount of space down there. It's not like you can spread out.
Hope they have vitamin D pills because we learned that in Truman Show. They're taking vitamin D because they're not actually out in the real sun.
They have that mush that's everything the body needs. Conveniently explained, but not explained where they get it from.
Like a bowl of snot. We talked about most of the cast already. Lawrence Fishburne is so cool in this movie. Very well cast. We covered it in Apocalypse Now and Boys in the Hood. The role could have gone to Gary Oldman or even his doppelganger, Fishburne's, that is, Samuel L. Jackson, who would have been very good in the role to begin with. I think if Will Smith had gotten the main role of Neo, they would have gone with the white guy. They probably wanted that contrast. And Fishburne is a pretty big name, for sure. It's not like you're casting some nobody and you're just trying to be inclusive. It is cool, though, that the trio of people, white guy, black guy, woman. And as we said before, the woman is as cool and as important as anyone else. And in the third movie, she's with Neo when he's trying to go to the source, whatever the hell they call it. She dies before they get there, but she's trying to be right by his... She is right by his side. She's his... I don't know if they actually get married, but she's his wife, effectively. So they're a team the whole way through, the three of them.
Morpheus means dream. Nebuchadnezzar, the name of the ship. Nebuchadnezzar was a biblical king who was haunted by a bad dream. You might say that Morpheus is kind of a magical Negro, except that there's the most magical Negro of all magical Negroes in this film via the Oracle. Yeah. She is just central casting for magical Negro, so...
There's two of them in this case.
Yeah, kind of.
Gloria Foster plays her. She died during production of Reloaded, so Mary Alice played her in Revolutions. And if you think about the fact that whenever they see her, she's in the Matrix, forgetting what we already said, that it's probably that the whole thing is a simulation, but just in the Matrix world, she can look like anything, and she does acknowledge that she had to change her identity for some reason.
They should have cast a 10-year-old or somebody who looked completely different from her, rather than cast someone who looks almost exactly like her. It would have made more sense to have her change her appearance really dramatically. What's that called? The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. Your lead actor dies, so you just cast 3 other actors and make it part of the film.
Yeah, because remember, he goes into the Imaginarium. Yeah. He's Johnny Depp, Jude Law, and...
Heath Ledger, of course.
No, Heath Ledger's the real guy, the one who died.
Yeah, okay, yeah, yeah.
There's 3 different actors. I forget who the third one is right now. Maybe Colin Firth? Colin Farrell, that's it. Okay. And there's a Colin F., not Colin Firth. Right, the movie's 2391. We watched the Blu-ray. It looks pretty good. It's held up quite nicely. Cinematographer Bill Pope also shot Bound for the Wachowskis, and Spider-Man 2, which I think we're going to cover later this year, because that'll be the 15-year anniversary. And now he works a lot with Edgar Wright. If you notice, The Matrix has a green tint to it, and the real world has a blue tint to it.
You know, we haven't really talked about much yet is the bullet time effect. This isn't the first thing to ever use bullet time. It had been used in music videos and ads and stuff, but never did it look nearly as good as it does in The Matrix. After The Matrix, we just started seeing it everywhere. Of course, now with 3D animation, you look at the Marvel films, and so much of it truly isn't for real on camera. So much of it is created from scratch, so they can really create that 3D effect on their own, and it doesn't really feel special anymore. But when The Matrix came out, this was mind-bending, eye-exploding. Everybody was freaking out about it.
It's cool to see the making of when Keanu is doing that. He's on wires, of course, which are removed. But it's a series of still cameras, as I remember the making of talked about this. And they have all those individual shots going off. And then I don't remember how they did this exactly, but with visual effects and everything, they merged it so it looks like it's just one clean shot going around him. Same with Carrie Ann Moss earlier in the film.
In the history of cinema, the very first piece of motion picture made with a camera was created by Edward Muybridge. He was just like a guy who was rich and had time and a lot of cameras, apparently, and he set up all these trip wires with cameras so that when a horse ran by, he would trip the cameras, and he had 24 cameras, and you're probably familiar with the original zoetrope, the galloping horse, and it's a 24 frames, and that is the very first motion picture that was ever made, and he did it with the same technique of 24 cameras set up with tripwires, although it's not tripwires, obviously, with the bullet time, but still, it's the same technique of using separate cameras rather than one camera with a strip of film moving really quickly through it.
And it is one of the most imitated and lampooned movies and sequences, for that matter, ever.
I wonder if somebody who is, say, 19 years old saw this movie for the first time today, if they would watch it and be impressed. But I think it still looks so good. And also, everything that goes on around it is so well done. The action moves at such an excellent pace. The music, the acting, everything comes together. And so it's not a gimmick in the end. It's just a really cool addition to a bunch of other great action scenes.
And you don't like Reloaded very much, but it has that action sequence on the highway with Fishburne and the agents. That was cool.
If that movie only gave us that car chase, then it was actually kind of worth it. It's so cool.
The editor was Zach Steinberg, who cut the Matrix sequels. His first movie, though, was Police Academy. What a way to get started. And that music, which I thought was really good, Don Davis, who worked on the sequels, of course, and Bound. We often say you're not a big fan of music in movies. This is big and bombastic, but I think it's very appropriate. And I think this music has stayed with me for a long time hearing it again. I remember it like it's yesterday I first heard it.
It's a good score. It's the type of movie that needs a big bombastic and futuristic for the time. At least time appropriate for 1999. Although I think it ages well. It doesn't sound corny to me. Mm. It's not like Saxophone in a Lethal Weapon movie that just puts you right back in the 80s.
I like that sax.
Well, I like this music too. And maybe, again, somebody who is 19 or 20 watching this film now might think the music is really dated. But I don't think so.
What do you think of Steinberg's Oscar-winning cutting?
Oh, excellent. It actually doesn't surprise me that his first movie was Police Academy. When I think of somebody who makes a really good editor, especially for stuff like action scenes where you have to have such a keen sense of timing, I think comedic timing and action timing are the same instincts. And being able to cut an individual scene that well, it's kind of the same toolbox. And yes, I am saying that Police Academy is a great comedy. And whatever, when I was a kid, I loved those movies. I will defend the original Police Academy movie. And as pacing as a story goes, I think that Matrix is actually excellent editing.
It's over 2 hours long, but I don't think it really feels like it is.
Like you said, it starts with the phone call. They make some interesting choices story-wise of how they reveal information and introduce characters. And these are choices that may have been made in the screenplay sense, but they're also remade at the very least in the edit suite.
Bill Pope's cinematography was not nominated for the Oscar. I mentioned that Steinberg won for editing. It also won visual effects. John Gaeta was one of the big guys for that. The bullet time thing he's involved in the making of. You see him on camera for that talking about the bullet time thing. And it also appropriately won for sound and sound effects. So it was nominated for 4 Oscars and won 4 Oscars. And I think I read somewhere that that's the most ever clean sweep without getting a nomination for Best Picture.
Really?
Other movies have won only one on one nomination or maybe even three. But they didn't get a Best Picture nomination or obviously win Best Picture, so... I don't know if I would put this in the Best Picture race that year. This was one of my favorite years for movies ever. We talked about it being the peak of culture. They say that in the movie. Well, when it comes to movies, I would say it's one of the peaks. I think this was a fantastic year.
There's so many great films that didn't get nominated for Best Picture.
My top 10 list didn't cover anything close to my favorite movies that year. I had at least 30 I thought were terrific. And we're going to cover, I don't know how many more this year, but definitely a few more. And we've already covered some before. American Beauty and Fight Club we did before this year. The movie made the National Film Registry in 2012. Not a strong year for movies going into the Library of Congress. A League of Their Own, which was pretty good, was that year. And Breakfast at Tiffany's also went in. We covered those two movies long ago. The Matrix was 66 in the top 100 thrills. Psycho was number one. I think The Matrix could have been even higher than that. But it should have been on the top 100 genres in the sci-fi category. That was a pretty good list of sci-fi movies. And this did not make it. I think it should have been crammed in there somehow. Or even fantasy. Very worthy. And then Neo was nominated for the top 50 heroes. As far as connections go... The Wachowskis do not deny it was based on anime. People have said that it rips off Ghost in the Shell pretty directly, the animated thing, not the Scarlett Johansson movie from a few years ago, obviously, and Akira as well. I don't know much about anime. I have to just go on what other people say. Dark City, which came out a year before this, Roger Ebert loved that movie, has a similar look and similar style, and people have said this movie ripped it off. Well, they wrote the script many years before, and they don't rip off a movie this elaborate a year later.
Dark City wasn't the first movie that ever was people living in a simulation. They didn't invent the idea. Everybody isn't ripping them off.
And
they
being were... dark and nighttime all the time, yeah. Or seeming like it is. The Matrix isn't nighttime all the time, but it's always not really truly sunny until the end of Revolutions. There's a lot of links to other things, properties and movies especially that came before this. Alice in Wonderland, they mentioned the White Rabbit. The Alice in Wonderland thing is mentioned many times by many characters, actually. Wizard of Oz, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, all of them are comparable in this movie. Also, there's similar themes in the Terminator series and even Total Recall.
I think there's an influence of queer culture, the very androgynous looks that they have, as well as a very counterculture look.
Who's prettier, Keanu Reeves or Carrie Ann Moss? Probably Keanu Reeves, and she's not bad looking.
Yeah, they look great in those outfits, though. Both of them look absolutely outstanding.
All right, then, final thoughts on one of the most influential movies of all time, and it's about time we covered it, 20 years after it came out, The Matrix.
Before we revisited it, I was very curious to see how I thought this movie aged and if it was a movie of its time or a forever film. Watching it again, enjoying it, even though I've seen it so many times now, it's just so fun and successful at everything it does. The effects don't seem dated. I think this is a forever film. I'm pretty happy to conclude this will be a classic.
It is a classic.
I think it is, yeah.
The AFI is obviously never going to do other lists. They haven't for many years. But if they ever did another top 100 list of great movies, not of genres or any of that kind of thing, not like thrillers like they've done before, but of the greatest movies, this has got to make it. It should have probably in 2007.
People our age are going to love The Matrix forever. The true test will be young people now. I know I keep bringing it up, but I'm just so curious about how it's aged for people watching it for the first time now. But I have to say, I think it's just such a good movie that it doesn't matter. Anybody could enjoy it on any level, no matter if you were there in the time and place when it came out or if you were just watching it and enjoying it for what it's worth now.
Whoa. Okay, when we return in a week, we've got yet another movie directed by a woman. We mentioned this earlier. Amy Heckerling's Clueless. This one's for Eve. We said if you wrote a review on Apple Podcasts, we'd consider reviewing the movie you suggested. She suggested a bunch. Some pretty good ones. Some other ones I don't really care so much about. I don't know much about Clueless. I haven't seen it in a long time, but we picked this one because why not?
Hi, Eve.
Okay, the coming attractions trivia for Clueless. What a left turn from The Matrix this is. It's been big time left turns lately, though. There are three women who've directed four movies that have grossed $100+ million when you adjust for inflation. Name them. You could probably guess one of them because why am I asking if Amy Heckerling's not one of the three? This is going to require some digging. And if there's more than three, I'd be surprised. I looked up every famous woman I could ever think of. And it's not easy to find out who the other two are.
For the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast about Clueless. But what if you just can't wait until then? Well, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, check out our entire roster. We've covered almost 300 movies now. Actually, over 300 if you include scoring at the movies. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free, but perhaps in exchange, like Eve, you could write us a review, and if in that review you suggest a movie you'd like us to cover that we haven't already covered, we will seriously consider it. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51, or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Spark Plug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it is not case-sensitive.
This podcast is going bye-bye. Thank you, Joey Pants.
And cut.